The Watermelon Woman, released in 1996, is the first feature film directed by an African-American lesbian. The writer-director Cheryl Dunye also plays the main character, Cheryl, herself an aspiring filmmaker, who works in a video rental store with her friend Tamara, with whom she also has a videography business. Cheryl decides to make a documentary about a striking black actress she sees in a 1930s film called Plantation Memories, where she's credited only as the Watermelon Woman. While we follow Cheryl's quest for information, we also see Cheryl's romance with a white woman named Diana and Tamara's conflicts with their young white coworker Annie. We see episodes from Cheryl and Tamara's videography jobs, recording a black Jewish wedding and a black feminist music performance, clips from various old movies that Cheryl watches, street interviews asking people if they've heard of the Watermelon Woman, and Cheryl's direct address to the camera as she discusses her documentary project. Cheryl's research takes her through her mother and her mother's butch friend, Miss Shirley, to Tamara's cousin who collects black film memorabilia, to the archives of the Center for Lesbian Information and Technology with Annie, to an interview with Camille Paglia, and to an acquaintance of Diana's family who's the sister of the white woman director of Plantation Memories. Cheryl discovers that the Watermelon Woman, Faith Richardson, or Faye Richards, apparently had an affair with the white woman who directed Plantation Memories. Faye sang in Philly gay clubs and had a longtime relation with another black woman, June, who Cheryl tracks down just in time to get a letter from her before her last illness. The film ends with Cheryl's documentary and, spoiler alert, the news that the whole thing is fiction, because sometimes you have to make your own history.
Well, this film works on so many levels and is remarkable both as an intervention in Hollywood film, a commentary on film theory and Hollywood cinema and black lesbian politics. What do you think about her main device of creating a history that's been denied you, that her problem is that the character who's only identified as the Watermelon Woman in Hollywood films, and her problem that so many black characters, actors, were not even named. So she begins to create a history for this woman that doesn't exist. It's absent. So to what extent does that matter, that she's creating a history that is in part as much an act of her imagination as it is an uncovering of a history in archives, although you see scenes of her going to the library and women's studies.
Yeah.
It's quite clear that by the end of the film, there is no history. It's a creative act.
Well, I think what's interesting is that in this creative act, in this creative history, this fictional history, her attempt to get information through official sources never works. So she goes to the library, and they've got nothing on the Watermelon Woman. They have some stuff on Martha Page, but not anything who's the white woman director, who's sort of based on Dorothy Arzner, who was the actual white woman director working in Hollywood in the 30s. She goes to the library, and she doesn't find anything on the Watermelon Woman. She goes to Camille Paglia, who's a cultural critic and a women's studies professor and an expert on something or other, and she gets ridiculous commentary on watermelons.
A great swipe on Camille Paglia.
It really is, and one wonders whether she was aware of how much she was being made fun of by her very existence. But her actual sources for real information that she finds are the people she knows, are her queer community fellow members of this sort of multiracial lesbian queer community. And it turns out, you know, her mother's friend, Miss Shirley, it turns out, is in the family, as she says, and talks about, oh yeah, she used to sing for all us stone butches. And,
this sort of fictive kin idea of how family is described.
Yeah, I mean, she creates a history based on the sort of counter histories that in fact people are working on discovering. I mean, as you say, the history that she creates is in a lot of ways based on actual history, in that, for instance, Hollywood did not always credit African-American actors by their actual names. I mean, Willie Best, who performed in a lot of Hollywood movies, was credited as Sleep and Eat, which is a pretty insulting name to give anybody. It's pretty much as bad as the Watermelon Woman. So, I mean, the kinds of roles that were available to black women, which her friend Tamara says she can't watch that stuff from the 30s because they're always playing mammies. That's all they could get to do. And we find out a little bit about the history of race films, that there were black filmmakers working in the 20s and 30s and 40s and making films with black casts for black audiences.
And that's an interesting history uncovered as part of the film as well.
So it's based on real history. So I think we do learn some things about the real history of Hollywood cinema, of cinema through the film. But it also then becomes this sort of enabling gesture. If you don't have the history you need, you go out and you make it. And she does construct this history that works for her, that allows her to become a filmmaker.
A lot of feminist film theory works with this idea of desire and whose desires are produced and structured through cinema. And from a psychoanalytic point of view, as many feminist film theorists are, desire is also tied to anxiety, that we desire objects that also make us anxious, and that she is on a quest that where she struggles with her own desire. And I think part of what interested me in the film was she starts with this image from a made-up film called Plantation Memories, where this black woman is comforting a white woman whose husband is away in the Civil War. And this line, she says, "Mrs., he'll come back to you. He'll come back to you." And we return to that in the film, and it does position black women as sources of comfort to white women. It's a very, the history of black-white relationships are very much around comfort, where black people provide solace to white people. And the film also takes her into a kind of tabooed realm around that, because she has an affair with a white woman and she refuses to be kind of censored around her own sexual interest in white women. And what do you make of that in terms of the racial tensions around desiring across the racial divide? Because Spike Lee is taking that up in Jungle Fever, the not only the white gaze as black subject as object of the white gaze, but how to think about black desire, in this case, black lesbian desire. You've written an article about Dunya's work. What do you make of her working with that theme?
Well, I think in this film, we can see in The Watermelon Woman, she goes through this set of parallels with her relationship with Diana and Faye Richards' relationship with Martha Page.
Is the director in a white woman
who directed Plantation Memories, who in fact is played by Antonio Yuhas, who's the producer of The Watermelon Woman. So I think they had a thing going on at the time. But
she invents a lesbian relationship between the white woman director and the black actress. So what's that about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's clearly, I mean, the sex scene between Cheryl and Diana is pretty racy, and in fact was the reason that it got some Republicans all uptight about the National Endowment for the Arts having given some money to the production of this film.
And it was a very erotic scene for its time. I mean, it's still kind of racy.
Yeah.
But it's crossing the racial divide. So there's clearly
desire there, but the other characters in the film, I mean, her friend Cheryl's friend Tamara is very critical of her relationship with Diana, although we can also see some problems in Tamara's relationships.
Everybody's desires are complicated.
Everybody's desires are complicated. It's true. Yeah. And other people in the film are critical of Faye's relationship with Martha Page as something that she did to get ahead in Hollywood. So, I mean, there's a way in which there's a kind of acknowledgement that part of the attraction is potentially the sort of racial privilege that white women have, that white people have a kind of cachet, perhaps, because of the unearned power that white people have in society, that is, in fact, maybe part of what's potentially sexy, but also
instrumental,
and also what's troubling about it. But then that relation, Cheryl's relationship with Diana ends when it turns out that actually Tamara was right, and Diana has like a long history of getting involved with black people, and it seems like it's more about a sort of fetishism of race on Diana's part than her actual interest in Cheryl as a person.
Yeah. And so there are some cautionary tales there. But I also think, you know, you've written about how this film works with the idea of the gaze, and Laura Mulvey wrote a classic paper on the heterosexual male gaze. And in this, she works with that idea. And you're aware she's looking for something. She brings herself into the film, and that there's something constructed always going on in films. And also the camera is very unstable. It wavers, you know, off there in these shoots. And the camera operators, these women start looking at other women in the audience. So it wavers.
When they're doing the videography of the music event, some of the camera operators are just kind of looking around, looking at the lovely, attractive women in the audience, and that's not what you're supposed to be doing right now. You're supposed to just film the acts, okay? Stop looking at the gorgeous women in the audience.
And that was a very interesting scene, because it also brought into the film itself this idea of that there's always something that's excluded from the scene, and there's always something kind of unstable about how desire operates in film.
And that film is about desiring. And I think that's one of the really interesting things. I mean, Laura Mulvey's famous article that you mentioned, where she sort of comes up with the idea of the male gaze, which is now sort of dispersed throughout society, and people who have never read Laura Mulvey know about the idea of the male gaze, because it's such a compelling and accurate account of something going on in society. And Laura Mulvey is talking about the male gaze as shaping the narrative and the desiring structure of classic Hollywood cinema.
And the man as the holder of the gaze, and woman as object of the gaze.
Yeah, that in classic Hollywood films, there's the male protagonist is looking at this attractive woman, and then the audience is also looking at the attractive woman and identifying with the male protagonist. I mean, that sort of classic film is directed at a white male heterosexual viewer. I mean, Mulvey's writing in the 70s. She doesn't go into him being a white and heterosexual male viewer, but that's...
But it still applies in a way.
Yeah.
And so how do you think she's complicating that idea with the black lesbian gaze?
Yeah.
Part of it is she brings it out into her project.
Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely get the awareness that this is constructed, which is one of the things that Mulvey talks about as... You know, the fact that we're not invited to think about the fact that movies are fake, that we're invited to be sort of hypnotically absorbed in the experience of watching. As though it's naturally unfolding in front of us. We're just voyeurs. But here we have, you know, she's talking to the camera, and we know that she's operating the camera. And so it's clearly a constructed work. And it's also one that's clearly engendered by, or shaped by, spurred by black lesbian desire, black desire for another woman. I mean, she decides to make this movie because she sees this woman in the film Plantation Memories, and says, you know, girlfriend's got it going on. You know, there's something about her face. There's just something about her performance. The idea that, and this is something that in the years since Mulvey's work, more film critics have sort of noted and talked about, the idea that in fact performers exceed their role sometimes, that the structure of the film that is meant to be giving us a singular kind of view, that is meant to be directed toward the illusory coherence of the white male spectator, is in fact much more complicated.
I think also it reminded me of bell hooks and black looks, that different audiences bring different sensibilities to it, that she could look at those hideous, those old images that evoked Gone with the Wind in that era, and see something else going on there. And Bell Hooks speaks to that so beautifully in talking about Amos and Andy and many films that were clearly racist and produced for white audiences that mocked or erased black people, but how black audiences can take them up in new ways. And she, I think Bell Hooks would have liked this, like this film, is in that spirit of different ways of using these old films.
Yeah, Hooks talks about the oppositional gaze, right? So Mulvey is talking about the ways that films position their viewers or expect the intended viewer to be this heterosexual white man, whereas Hooks talks about the fact that when you're not that figure, you have to find some resistant way, oppositional way, to engage with what you're seeing.
And that's a more creative and less passive process.
Yeah, so you're not identifying, you're disidentifying, you're resisting, you're talking back to the screen, you're interpreting things in willful ways that don't align with the intentions of the director necessarily, with the intentions of the film or the screenwriter. So the ways that cultural products can be put to new uses is something that we definitely see in this film. I mean, she's working at a video store, and she, like, they have this scam, and she sees Plantation Memories because they order these films under customers' names and then send them back. So they have this way of getting the film, sort of using the system that, in a larger sense, is oppressive to serve her own ends, to serve her own creativity.
And create something subversive.
And create something new. Yeah.
And I think in closing we should say that this was not her only work. She's a remarkable filmmaker and scholar. She's Cheryl Dunye's taught at a number of colleges, film theory, and has gone on to do other work. And I think we should add a link to your article on her work.
And you can get in line to get a copy of this at the Multnomah County Library. I think there are some holds already, but put your hold in and you can get hold of the film.
Great way to spend an afternoon during Pride Month.
For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle
and Jan Hawken
talking about The Watermelon Woman.
Go see it and discuss among yourselves.
Pink like the inside of your baby, pink behind all of the doors. Crazy pink like the tongue that goes down. Maybe pink like the paradise found. Pink when you're blushing inside. Baby, pink is the truth you get.